The darkness around us is deep. William Stafford concludes his much-loved poem, A Ritual to Read to Each Other, with that flat statement, as he describes it. The darkness around us is deep. The darkness around us may be deep, but in the time we spend with Stafford's poems, we're not led to despairing. The poet tells David Elliott in Conversation that he's made his peace with the depth of darkness in our lives. I'm sort of glad, I feel at home in the dark where I live. What then of Stafford's use of the words awake or waking in his works, asks Elliott. Stafford explains, coming awake is coming out of ignorance and darkness into some kind of awareness, but even the condition of being awake is not really being awake to what's there. There's no way to penetrate or encompass fully the mysteries that are around us. David Elliott has talked deeply over the years with a number of poets, and when he brought those interviews together into a volume, he returned to William Stafford for the title, At Home in the Dark, sensing that, as different as these writers are, there is something about the way they turn their attention to life and lives and living in every sense that makes this collection come together, and come together to reveal not just the various ways these writers work with words, but the ways they have of illuminating that darkness for all of us. David Elliott is the author of three books of poetry, Through the Silence, Wind in the Trees, and Passing Through. His poetry has also appeared in several anthologies, including Haiku in English, The First 100 Years, the Haiku Anthology, Haiku Moment, an anthology of contemporary North American haiku, Got Verse, and Palpable Clock, 25 Years of Mulberry Poets. He is professor emeritus at Keystone College in La Plume, Pennsylvania, where he taught creative writing, literature, composition, and the history of jazz. Longtime WVIA listeners will remember David Elliott from the Poetry Minutes programs the Mulberry Poets and Writers Association produced with WVIA to mark Poetry Month in Pennsylvania over the years. Dr. Elliott returned to what we still call the poetry chair in the WVIA studios to talk with us about this new volume issued by Keystone College Press in anticipation of a celebration of the release this Thursday on the Keystone campus in La Plume, a school where David Elliott spent many years.
I started teaching at Keystone in the fall of 1976. When I arrived, I had no knowledge of or reason to think that there was anything particularly poetry-centered at Keystone. Poetry was not part of the equation in terms of why I was hired or my attraction to the school or whatever. But when I started, I decided that I wanted to have poetry readings. And so in the spring of 1977, my first year, I invited a friend of mine from Syracuse, Stephen Dunn, to read his poetry. And I taught at Keystone for 37 years, retired in 2013, and for each of those 37 years, I brought a poet to Keystone in the spring. And we had Pulitzer Prize winners and Poets Laureate and a lot of very well-known poets.
You also had connections to the community at large in Scranton, for example.
Yes. In 1977, I was invited to be one of the people who got a poetry reading series started that was sponsored by the Friends of the Scranton Public Library. And the first reading in that series as an official series was in the fall of 1977. And I believe, it's a long time ago, but I believe the first poet was Jay Perini, appropriately.
Native of Scranton.
And the following fall was the first one that I was, you know, we were taking turns. Who do you want? Who do you want? Who do you want? There were four of us who were working together. So the first poet that I brought was Gary Snyder in 1978. And the library series, Friends of the Library series, went until, I think, 2001. And over the course of its history, we brought about 75 poets and writers to Scranton, plus the 37 that I brought to Keystone. A lot of poets were reading in Scranton over those years. But I think altogether, I was involved in, not necessarily single-handedly, but involved in bringing probably about 120 poets here. So if somebody were to ask me, well, what about the really creme de la creme of all those poets? There would be names that are not in this book. This book came together rather haphazardly. It was something that I wasn't even thinking about for the first years of bringing poets to Keystone and being part of the Friends of the Scranton Public Library series. But when W.S. Merwin came, who was a real favorite of mine going back to college, I wanted to ask him about an interview. And that was, he was there in the fall of 1983. And a very busy schedule. And he said, well, yes, I'd like to do it. But he had moved to Hawaii. He was not on the East Coast very much, although he was more than he is now. And he said, I'm going to be back East in a year. So why don't we do it then? So the interview was in 1984. And that was the first one. And I quickly learned that doing that kind of an interview is a lot of work. I mean, first of all, you have to do all your research and formulate the questions and so on. And then once you have a tape, it was at the time, of course, you have to transcribe it. And that is not easy. And one thing that you quickly learn is that when people are talking, even if they're talking very articulately, if you just put word for word absolutely what it was said on the page, it's not going to read very well very often, not very smooth. So a lot of editing has to occur. And with all of my interviews, I did that in very close conjunction with the poets. I mean, I said, here's my transcription, which was already cleaned up a bit, not necessarily making everything a complete sentence, since fragments are fine, of course, in terms of conversation, but making sense of it, maybe taking out some things which were just, let's go get a cup of coffee or something. And then they would look at it. And in some cases, they played a very active role. They said, well, I'd like to change this word that I used. So I didn't feel that something about the sanctity of the words that were actually uttered in that interview, if the poet wanted to improve upon what they said, that was fine with me.
When you talked about haphazard, you began, but then you decided at some point that this would be an ongoing project.
More or less. It was something that I knew I wanted to do again. I didn't quite finish about how it's so much work. Then once all the editing is done, then you have to try to get it published. All of these interviews were published in literary journals around the country. And so I just, okay, that went well. I'll do another one. The second one was William Stafford. He came to Keystone. We also brought him in the library series. So he was one of the people who was, was here twice. But I was not thinking of a book at all. And I wasn't thinking of a project in the sense of, I want to interview people about these kinds of issues, or I want to interview this kind of poet. It was just when a poet was put on the docket, so to speak, I thought, well, that's somebody I think I'd like to do. But I wasn't, saying because I interviewed these people before, or because I'm thinking of interviewing these people in the future. It was just going from one to one to one. So altogether, I did 10 interviews. And the last one was with Marie Howe, and that was it took a while before that was published. It was published, I think, in 2001. I think the interview was actually in 99, maybe 2000. And then years went by. And when I was working with Ray Hammond, who's in charge of the Keystone Presses and who had said that he wanted to publish my poetry book about a year and a half ago, was when that got started, I just said to him, I've got these interviews. And I'm wondering if you might be interested in doing this. He said, oh, that's great, because Keystone is going to create a new imprint, Keystone College Press, and more scholarly, because Nightshade Press, publishing poetry books, has been around at Keystone with a little kind of off and on, but around at Keystone for over 10 years. So anyway, Ray was very enthusiastic about it. And once the poetry book was done, that's what I spent the last year doing.
What were your hopes in bringing poets to the area?
Well, all poets are kind of engaged in the process of trying to bring more people over to poetry. One of the quotes that I have here from Patty Ann Rogers is talking about one of the reasons why people are kind of hesitant about wanting to go to a poetry reading or whatever. Of all of the literary arts, have to face the facts that in America, poetry is probably at the bottom of the ladder in terms of most people's sense of what they want to read. And so expanding the audience for poetry and appreciation of poetry was all of us involved in bringing the poets here, you know, that's in the back of our minds for sure, or in the front of our minds as well. But yeah, trying to increase the audience. And we were very pleased with a lot of the audiences that we had for the poets in the Friends of the Library series. Some of the big draws, I mentioned Gary Snyder, W.S. Merwin, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. People just, you know, filled the house, whatever it happened to be. We had many venues over the years for where the readings actually occurred, but those were all at the Everhart Museum. Robert Bly was another one who was a big draw.
Did Merwin say he thought about it and he'd like to have the conversation with you was part of the fact that he was from or spent time growing up in Scranton? Or do you think it was a connection he made with you?
I don't know the answer to that question. I know that he was pleased to return to Scranton, where he grew up, and he had just, I believe he had just married his wife. They were together, certainly, and she came with him, and he was very glad to have the opportunity to show her around Scranton, and where he grew up on Washburn Street, West Side Scranton. So I'm sure he had positive feelings in the Friends of the Library series.
And he's grown as a writer.
Oh, yes.
And so have you. And so it must have been fascinating to sit down with someone you knew as a writer and to speak with him with that history under your belt.
I was in the straight literature program, not the creative writing program, and my PhD dissertation was on five contemporary American poets, including W.S. Merwin. So that was another thing, approaching him as a poet and approaching him as a critic, so to speak. At the time, he was associated with what some people were calling the deep image poets, who were writing about... In my dissertation, I talk about Carl Jung and the ideas of collective unconscious and archetypes and so on. And Merwin's poems seemed to be written from a very, very deep place. They were not written with great details of the physical world and place names and so on. It was like sort of like an archetypal world that he was writing from. And that, plus the political aspect at the time of writing about the Vietnam War, made him a very interesting poet.
And you talked with him about myth here.
Yes.
What can you tell us in this conversation about what might have come out?
Well, would you like me to read a section from his interview? Mythology is not merely something you learn in school that the Greeks had to make statues to illustrate a couple of thousand years ago. It is everything that helps us to make sense of the world. Any real use of language is mythic in some sense. Language is articulation of myth. Let me see, there's another quote here. One of the things that always used to give me heart when I was described as hopelessly obscure and surrealist was that children were not having any trouble at all reading the poems.
And how about his sense of the natural world and nature? You mentioned Gary Snyder in those days.
Both of them in different ways, but... Yes, well, one of the things about Merwin, which I'm very, very impressed with, I mentioned that he moved to Hawaii, and he quickly made as a lot of his life work preserving trees, species of trees that were endangered. And Merwin's estate, that makes it sound like some rich person's house, but nevertheless, the land that he owns, where he lives, he's made it really into a conservatory, which is saving and protecting all of these rare trees and other forms of vegetation as well. But it's an important resource for biologists and so on. He's quite old now. He was born in 1927, and he's virtually blind. And sad to say, his wife Paula died a few years ago. For a while, he was really dictating his poems to her. It makes you think of Milton, you know. I don't know if he's writing now or not.
I think one of the fascinating things about this book, David, is you didn't have an overall focus theme. What I experience in going through the book is the fact that this is what poetry can be, and this is what poetry can be, and this is what poetry can be. And we get a sense of this wonderful human art that poetry is.
Yes, and of the great variety of poets in this country. And approaches to poetry. One of the things that I mentioned in the preface that the process of putting this book together made me realize is that some of the same issues were addressed by most of the poets, or many of the poets. That partly had to do with the fact of the kinds of things that interest me. So I was asking some of the same questions or related questions. But nevertheless, it's almost like within the book there are poets kind of answering each other. Plus, sometimes a poet in the book, like Merwin, who is so well known, gets mentioned by some of the other poets in the course of their answers and so on.
Which is very nice, but not...
Not planned.
In this connection, David, the notion that you yourself are not just an English professor, and so you know the craft of poetry entering that way, but you're a poet yourself. The fact is that in talking poet to poet, it isn't an exclusive conversation. We don't feel left out because you're a poet talking to a poet.
You mean in the sense that it's not like too shop talky that might not interest other people? Yeah.
You have photography and music in your life and so many things, and you bring all of those interests to your conversation with these wonderful, rich human beings. And it's that level, I think. But it doesn't hurt that you know about the craft of poetry.
Right. Well, thank you. Well, for example, as you know, I'm very, very interested in jazz. And my interview with Robert Creeley, a lot of what we talked about was jazz, because I knew he was interested in jazz, and I was really interested in seeing how he would tie that with his writing. There are some of the interviews, like the one with Robert Morgan, for example, that are fairly poet shop talk oriented, but I hope goes beyond that as well.
That's important, too, for those who are being drawn to poetry. We get a sense that it's not an easy thing to write a good poem.
And that's something I know from being a creative writing teacher that a lot of people don't understand. I mean, if you think of all the arts, visual arts, musical arts, etc., poetry is the one that uses as its medium the language that we speak all the time, that's in our head, in our thoughts all the time. All the other media for arts are something else, playing an instrument, painting a painting. And that makes people feel that because they can speak, that of course they can write poetry, and not realizing that even though they know that if you're a musician, you have to take lessons and do a lot of practice, a lot of beginning writers kind of think, well, hey, I can speak English, therefore I should, you know, be able to write poetry just like that.
It ain't so.
It ain't so. No, it's as much an art that you have to learn as any of the other arts.
And the other thing is, of course, that you're a wonderful person to do an interview because you listen well. And as a poet, you have to not just be able to put those words down on paper, but you have to be able to listen in so many senses to the world around you.
And you also have to listen to your internal world. And something that a number of the poets say, and which many artists, all kinds of artists say, and many, many poets have said, and that is that when you write a poem, you don't know what you're going to write. You see where it goes. So you have to be sensitive to the outside world and everything, your environment and so on, but you also have to be able to allow your internal world, which might not be fully known to you, thank you, Freud, and see where things lead you.
And then when you put on your interviewer's cap, you're listening as you ask a question and hear the answer and are preparing to continue the conversation. You're listening to what they say because they're poets. They use words. They love the language. But also what's in between the lines and the body language and all of that, right?
Yeah. And their tone of voice. I mean, the thing that people learn from going to poetry readings is that no two poets read the same way. And once you hear a poet read their work, the next time you read their work on the page, you can hear their voice. You know how they approach the language when they put those words out into the air.
You mentioned knowing Stephen Dunn. Tell us about his coming and your talking with somebody you might have known.
Yeah, well, it was very interesting. I'll say again, I was not in the creative writing program at Syracuse, which was an excellent creative writing program. And I only took one creative writing course there. The teacher was a very fine poet named Philip Booth. And the one class that I was in, there were seven of us, and two of the other poets were Stephen Dunn and Larry Levis. Larry is a less known than Stephen, who got the Pulitzer Prize, but very, very highly regarded. And so really two of the best poets of my generation, you know, were in that class. One of the things that was interesting about Stephen is that he was a basketball player. He went to Hofstra and played varsity basketball for Hofstra. And when he got out of college, he started playing semi-pro basketball, and he played with the Williamsport Billies for, I think, 2 years, at least 1 year. But anyway, excellent, excellent athlete. Can I read you a quote from him which talks about basketball? Basketball was my first way of having a chance to be better than myself. And poetry offers the same possibility, that you can exceed yourself. You can be better than yourself, though there are greater undersides in poetry, of course. By exceeding yourself, you may find out things that are not particularly sanguine, that are troublesome. I think that's why one yearns for the purity of basketball, in which there is transcendence without terrible consequence. That's the adolescent dream, to perpetuate play forever. Whereas the moments when I've been better than myself in poems were often troublesome, because if you exceed yourself in a poem, Often you may have learned something that was probably happily buried within your subconscious and went down there for a certain reason.
Have you had that experience
poet? Oh, sure, yeah. And again, you don't know what's going to come out when you write a poem, and again, from the depths. So yes, he was the first poet that I brought to Keystone. I brought him again to Keystone in the 90s, I think it was, and that's when this interview occurred. And in between there, I also brought him in the library series, the Friends of the Library series.
Not to reduce him, but how do you present him to a class when you're trying to say, now we're going to read Stephen Dunn?
Well, he's a poet who tries to be understandable, for one thing. He doesn't write really obscure poems. I mean, a lot of psychological sophistication and so on. But a lot of his poems are about human interaction between spouses, between parent and child, with friends. He writes about many things, but an awful lot of it is really about relationships and ways of being in the world in a social sense. I don't mean like going to cocktail parties or something, but interacting with other people and with the issues that the world is presenting us.
You mentioned Robert Creeley in music. I'm always intrigued by your love of music and your knowledge of jazz and your son who is on the world stage as a jazz musician. He's a remarkable player. Tell us a little bit more about the interaction with Robert Creeley and what you discovered.
Well, he is of a generation who was coming of age in the 40s. He was born in the 20s. There's this wonderful generation of American poets who were born in the 1920s. And he's one of them. Merwin is one of them, of course. Snyder, 1930, just sort of barely. So he was coming of age and interested in jazz when Charlie Parker was starting to play in the 1940s. And so I asked him about that, and he told an amusing story. It's kind of a long story, but when he went to see Parker, and Parker wound up only playing like for 30 seconds and then disappeared, left the rest of the band on their own. But he was interested in bebop, the kind of jazz that Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk were starting in the 1940s, and a kind of, fragmented sort of approach to playing jazz. I mean, not the kind of smooth swing band music that was the popular music of the day, but more frenetic. And Creeley was also interested in the idea of improvisation. And you could really say that he improvises his poems in the sense that you might say that everybody's improvising their poems, of course. That's what writing is. But by that I mean that at least at some point, how early he started doing this, when he writes a poem, he didn't revise them. Now, he told me that doesn't mean that he published everything he wrote. But when he wrote a poem, it was like taking a solo as a jazz musician. And what comes out, and that's it.
And Marie Howe is a poet who writes so movingly about the human experience of loss.
Marie Howe's book, What the Living Do, is largely about the death of her brother from AIDS. Plus, she knew a lot of other people in the poetry world who were, who got AIDS and were involved also in support. But she has a wonderful poem, which I don't have with me, but I'm going to read at the event about her brother. Altogether, I brought her to this area three times, once in the library series and twice to Keystone. And one of the last poets that I brought to Keystone before I retired in 2013. This was not that interview, but the one that, as I said, that was around 99, 2000.
A quote then, please.
This week I have no faith in language. I must tell you I don't. But that's my failing, not languages. I feel like it's the last outpost for us humans. I take it very seriously. I feel language has been utterly cut off by this culture and used in the service of consumerism, and that poetry insists on the integrity of words, of a word. It's terrifying, really terrifying, what Madison Avenue and people who sell things are doing. I feel like poets and writers are the monks writing illuminated manuscripts in the sense of trying to preserve the integrity of language, just to expand the possibilities for expression, because the culture is trying to push us into the same 20 words over and over again. It's a bewildering time, a very difficult time, but I still feel that poetry is a medium for the human voice or outcry, for the human experience. It's deep and clear. I have faith in it. You don't have to pay a lot of money for it. You can memorize it and put it right in your body. There's something very important about making something that is valueless to the people who would co-opt it and sell it. And therefore, it's priceless and ineffable and belongs forever to humans who can handle it. I still have faith in that, in spite of everything else that's going on around us.
We don't need to embroider that. It stands by itself. But in our world today, what other better case to be made for poetry than that, right?
Absolutely.
What are your hopes for it as a book?
Well, I'm hoping that it's the kind of book that might get picked up by a lot of libraries. Hard to tell. I think Keystone Press is hoping that. It's going to be out in both hardbound and paperback. And I just hope it gets out there in one way or another, and people's interest in these particular poets would lead them to buying their books or whatever. A number of them are deceased. But just as we were talking earlier, increasing the awareness of poetry and hopefully the audience for poetry.
David Elliott, poet and professor emeritus at Keystone College in La Plume, speaking about his new collection titled At Home in the Dark, Conversation with 10 American Poets. The collection includes these writers: W.S. Merwin, William Stafford, Robert Creeley, David Ray, Robert Morgan, Naomi Shihab Nye, Stephen Dunn, Lucian Strike, Patty Ann Rogers, and Marie Howe. The book has just been released by Keystone College Press, and the book release party for At Home in the Dark will be held this Thursday, November 29th, from 7 to 9 p.m., and you are invited to attend. It's at Keystone College in La Plume in Evans Hall, and for more information on the web, keystone.edu, keystone.edu. That's a book release party for At Home in the Dark, just issued by Keystone College Press, featuring Conversations with 10 American Poets by Keystone College Professor Emeritus David Elliott. Dr. Elliott is a poet in his own right, and he will present a talk and some poetry, as we heard. And that's November 29th, this Thursday, at 7 in the evening at Keystone College in La Plume, Evans Hall. For more information, on the web, keystone.edu, keystone.edu.